Good morning. I'm Dr. Gay Carlson, president of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, with another of my Screenside Chats for our ACAP members. As you know, Screenside Chats are meant to share timely clinical information from experts on key topics during the COVID-19 pandemic that's continuing to haunt us. Reminiscent of President Roosevelt's fireside chats during the Great Depression and World War II, I'm hoping they'll be informative and comfortable and fill a niche not otherwise addressed in your other podcasts, etc. Today, I'd like to talk about a topic which we haven't addressed yet in this series, and that's the variable impact of COVID on children with developmental disabilities. Affected me personally. On one hand, I have a 7-year-old grandnephew with mild autism who's actually thriving. His 5-year-old little brother with some motor problems secondary to cerebral palsy is struggling. He can't see his beloved grandparents. He can't go to the zoo. More social than his older brother, he can't play with the kids he used to play with. And he's stuck with all of the motor challenges of school. And it's really demoralizing him. So today we're talking to Dr. Carol Weitzman, previously Director of Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics and Training Director at Yale. Dr. Weitzman is now co-director of the Autism Spectrum Center at Boston Children's Hospital and the Harvard School of Medicine, and still director of the Connecticut Center of Developmental Pediatrics. Nationally, she's president of the Society for Developmental and Behavioral Pediatrics and the immediate past chair of the American Academy of Pediatrics section on developmental pediatrics. She's interested in training. She has an NIMH grant to reduce disparities in identifying children at risk for autism spectrum disorder, and is also funded, and I think this really sounds neat, funded for an initiative designed to bring together a diverse group of professionals across disciplines and across the world who are interested in the developmental, emotional, and behavioral health of children and their families. So Dr. Weitzman, has COVID impacted children with developmental disabilities like autism and ADHD and developmental delays? Has it impacted them differently than children without those challenges? And if so, what kind of differences have you noticed?
First of all, thank you so much for inviting me here today. I'm just so delighted to be here to have this chat with you and to talk about this and share some ideas together. I think your story that you started with is kind of a telling story in that children are affected differently, and children with disabilities are affected differently. So there's no one answer to this, but I think in terms of themes, we do know that children with, and we'll say developmental disabilities, meaning a range of problems, autism, ADHD, intellectual disability, motor problems, have had more challenges than children who do not have these kinds of struggles. So I think some of the areas that are important and have impacted these children is, number one, there's been a significant loss of services for so many children. And so many kids who have fought so hard to gain skills have not necessarily maintained those skills. And oftentimes when we think of neurotypical kids and we think about the issue of skill loss or some regression, we kind of anticipate, oh, when they get back to normal, they're going to make those skills back up. But for some of these kids, that's a very hard road to achieve those. So the loss of services has been a huge issue. Number two is, I think we've learned that for many of these children, the transition to online learning has just not gone that well. Many of these children, particularly kids with autism and ADHD, you know, have difficulty sitting and tuning in and focusing and having the executive functioning skills to be able to manage online learning. So that has been very difficult. And I guess the third major theme that what I'd say is that there's been the loss of routine, I think, has been devastating for everybody and for all children. But for some of these children who are so highly dependent on regular routine, it's been created tremendous hardship and difficulty in functioning.
Are there particular mental health fallout that you've seen in kids and also in their families? Because, yeah, I think it has been a glitch. I have to say, for us in Long Island, I've been really pleased that those children who had needed the most services have actually continued with in-person learning. Even over the summer, you know, for kids with 12-month programming, they were actually physically able to go to school. So for those of us on Long Island who pay a lot of taxes, this is one time when I think we have something to show for it. But expecting kids with the various challenges to pay attention to online learning, yeah, that's pretty bad. What kind of mental health fallouts have you seen?
You know, I just want to comment on what you just said, and that is really about variability in services that I think we've seen. And I would say in Connecticut, there is a huge variation in service provision from some kids where some school districts have kind of acknowledged, you know, that children with more significant disabilities need 5-day-a-week programming and have provided that, to other places which are almost all exclusively remote learning. I think there's distinctions also across different economic areas. So I think we can talk about that hopefully a little later in the disparities in care that we're seeing emerging, which I think is a really, really serious issue. But at the question you're asking about mental health issues that we're seeing in kids, it's a really good question. And I think, again, we're seeing this almost many children, as you pointed out, which I think is spot on. Some kids are doing better, but a lot of kids, especially as this just drags on, are not. I think for some kids, we're seeing the two things that have come out the most for me are that there are kids struggling with more aggressive symptoms. A lot of that I think I tie towards loss of routine, changing routines. You know, one day we're doing it this way, one day we're doing it that way. Things are so thrown off. There's a lot more issues around aggression. And a lot of kids I have seen, particularly with autism, are struggling hugely with anxiety. A lot of anxiety about COVID, over literal interpretations about what this means. The kind of, again, unpredictable routine seems to have spiked a lot of anxiety in kids, such that there are kids who, some of whom are refusing to go to school, don't want to leave the house. It's not universal, but I think we're seeing a lot of it.
How have you felt that you've been able to be helpful? You know, our viewers are professionals, though I imagine some lay people probably tune in as well. But mostly we have an audience of professional people. How are you helping the families? What are you doing as far as the treatments you're able to offer remotely, or I imagine occasionally in person? How are you suggesting we intervene?
I'd like to hope that I've been able to be helpful to families through this ordeal. I would say there are a lot of ways to be helpful. The first thing I would say is we have to think beyond what the disability is and think about the whole family. How is the family functioning? Because you can have children, you know, if we only think about our patient and the disability, we have to think about this pandemic has impacted family functioning hugely. Unemployment, financial worries, increase in substance abuse in families. And I I'm sure you all say the same thing, but if parents aren't doing well, kids aren't doing well. So if we don't check in with how is the family system functioning, then we're going to potentially miss an awful lot. And it may be that one of the reasons why the children are experiencing a lot of symptoms is because the families aren't functioning well. So we have to check in about the larger picture. How is everybody doing? How has COVID touched them? Is this a family that's now dealing with grief and loss and these kind of issues? And sometimes we're thinking so much about the disorder. Oh, yes, this is the boy with autism, that we're not thinking that this boy lost somebody or is grieving with somebody or has somebody living at home who's quite sick, all of those things. So the first thing I think we can do to be helpful is to broaden our scope and to think about how is this family functioning? How are the siblings functioning? Who else is in the home? The second thing is to stay in close touch with families, particularly families who are having difficulty getting services and helping to get them the support. So I'm thrilled to hear on Long Island that kids are getting these services and supports, but there's a lot of places where I would have to say the squeaky wheel has moved things along. And there have been times where, you know, families who've made a lot of noise have been able to bring in a lot of supports or get schools to pay for supports. So the more we can be a presence to advocate for those families, I think the better.
So that advocacy piece really is vital. I agree that the squeaky wheel is a good analogy, because this is not a time to expect people are going to be just calling up and saying, hey, how are things with you today? They're not going to do that.
Not so much. No. Not so much. I think the other things we can think about are, this is a time where I think if kids are symptomatic, there might be under other circumstances, we take a little more of a watch and wait attitude. And probably if families are really stressed, if people are really struggling, that we should probably really listen to what parents need, listen to what the stress level of the kids or the family are, and treat symptoms aggressively. And, you know, you can always back off later on, but we may need to kind of, you know, put our foot on the gas pedal a little bit more during this time.
When we were chatting the other day on the phone, we were talking about there are times when if things were normal, we probably wouldn't have considered using medication. But now it may be that in terms of your foot on the pedal, that you were saying that you might consider that sort of differently. Tell me or flesh out a little bit what we were talking about.
Well, first of all, parents are spending a lot more time with their kids right now. So there are times, and I'm sure you all have had this experience, but I've had a lot of parents who, because they were with their kids during the day, during school, they just didn't see some of the behaviors the teachers were talking about. And now they're saying, we're seeing it. We are seeing it, and now they are much more on board. So that's sort of people spending more time with their kids and getting a little bit more in tune with it. The second is, you know, when kids are not sleeping, when kids are very aggressive, you know, I think we just have to be kind of say to parents, look, let's do something about that now. Not just, you know, we don't want to put blinders on still ever about just using medication and pulling out a prescription pen. We need to make sure we understand a little bit what's going on. You know, is this a kid who's using electronics and that's why they're not sleeping? So it's not like we should just toss aside all the good things we know. But I think we need to keep families functioning and kids functioning as best they can. I don't know, does that answer that question?
Well, as I said, we had sort of tossed around the fact that we might, we might end up increasing a medication or adding, doing things that ordinarily that wait and see or getting a feedback or whatever it is, we might not do. The other thing that you were saying reminds me of one of my favorite t-shirts. You know, the one that says, if mama ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. Anyway, have you seen that?
I don't know, but I like it.
You like it, right? But that's the point. The point is that where you have a stressed or anxious parent or a parent that isn't sleeping, that actually may be the person that ends up getting your intervention. And that will therefore help the rest of the family. You don't have to, you know, pick on one child at a time. But I think the point is that you end up doing things perhaps a little more aggressively than you might otherwise do. And that you can back off, that you can say this is a Band-Aid. You don't be, we're not going to use a Band-Aid. We need a Band-Aid. You know, you're dripping blood on your salad. We need a Band-Aid. We'll take it off when we don't need the Band-Aid, and we can regroup and so on. And again, I'm not pushing pills. I'm saying kind of what you said, which is we may need to see if we can reduce the symptom and stress level with advocacy, with helping the family system, with helping the parent, and doing whatever we can.
We're pushing not the pills. We're pushing functioning. We're pushing functioning. And you know, I think another layer to this is that because a lot of what we're doing is being delivered by telehealth, people get nervous that they feel, can I really make this assessment? You know, how am I going to really make sure that, you know, it's appropriate for me to use these medications? And I think we've learned, I'm going to talk about that, you know, maybe a little bit later, but what we've learned through telehealth is that we can do reliable evaluations. We can do reliable assessments. and that some of the things that we may need to be monitoring, kids' weight, you know, all of these other things, we can get that information. People, you know, we can say to people, I need this, but teachers, home, we can, there are workarounds for things that we never really thought there were. So I think being aggressive and telehealth has made people nervous, and I don't think we need to be quite so nervous is all I would say.
Are there some things that you can do in terms of the telehealth to monitor people that were sort of an eye-opener for you, like, oh, that's how I can do that, or, gee, I hadn't thought about doing that before. That's a good idea. Are there any little
ways to monitor things through telehealth? That's a good question. I mean, I think I was doing some of this stuff before, but I feel like recruiting schools to get me things like vital signs, you know, blood pressures, heart rate, weight. You know, I have plenty of kids who, if they come into my office, they don't want to stand on a scale. They get very, very agitated. You know, a lot of kids, you can kind of get them desensitized to that. But there are plenty of kids that between visits, I was relying on schools. But now I can do it even more. And you know what? I'll tell you the truth. If parents say, I'm just going to weigh him at home, or I've got one of these, everyone's got like a little home office nowadays. Everyone's got their own pulse ox and this and that because of COVID. So I'm like, okay, I'll take it. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be perfect. I just got to make sure you're not completely, you know, falling apart, meaning I don't really want to see you back in a few months and you're, you know, enormous or emaciated. So I don't, it doesn't matter to me if we're not exactly precise. I just need the ballpark. So I think, I don't know if that's anything particularly creative, but those are kind of some of the things I've been relying on.
I still feel how your clothes fit is the best gauge of whether your weight has changed. And I think we can address that personally as well as professionally.
That's a really good point.
Is there anything that we're learning now that when we do get back to some semblance of normal, we can say, I think we're going to continue to do that? Or, God, no, you know, I can't wait to see the back of this particular thing. Any things like that that you've been?
Yeah. I think, by the way, I'll just say that I think you have, and I don't know if others have said this, but I think you have by far the most pithy sayings out of anyone I know. So I'm going to see if I can come up with one, which I didn't even make. But it is, you know, people have said, don't let a good pandemic go to waste. You know, have you heard that expression? So, and I think we have to do some looking and seeing what are we learning from this, or we have to do that. I'll tell you a few things that come to mind. I think we have learned a lot about, and I know psychiatry was way ahead in using telehealth, so I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about this, but I think we've learned a lot about the value, not just that we are getting by with telehealth, but that we can actually do reliable evaluations of children through telehealth. There are even some preliminary studies coming out sort of showing that we can make diagnoses through telehealth, that in fact, being able to have some access, quite honestly, into people's homes and seeing children in natural environments has some advantage. I think we're just learning a world about this. And if I may, that I think we are challenging the, you know, there's a lot of dogma in life and in the things we do and sort of feeling like, this is how we do it. We have to do it this way. We need these professionals present for an evaluation. And I think we're learning that there are other alternative ways to doing things. And I see a tremendous amount of value in that in so many ways. It gives flexibility to families. I think we're going to be able to reach rural populations of people much better. And I think, you know, honestly, even when we think about workforce, I think we have lots of issues around workforce, around taking care of kids with developmental, behavioral, emotional, mental health problems. There just are lots of creative ways to be thinking about that. So I think that telehealth is here to stay, and we should continue to challenge dogma and ideas that we've held. So let me just, if I may, say two other quick things. Number one is, I'll tell you an interesting thing I've learned. A lot of people tend to sort of, if you will, sell people short, people, kids with disabilities short. Oh, they're never going to be able to do that. In the beginning, I was being asked all the time, could you write letters to excuse my child from wearing a mask? My kid will never be able to master wearing a mask. They're not, you know, and the world sort of, I feel like, thought, oh, that kid, he's so low functioning. That kid, he's nonverbal. He's not good. And you know what I've learned? A lot of these kids have done it. They've done it with good gradual desensitization techniques. They have been able to master some of these. So I feel like it has been, again, reinforcing, don't sell people short. Kids can do all sorts of things. It's not that they can't do it. They do it differently. They do it more slowly, and they need special supports to do it. So that was the second thing. And the third thing that I would say, I'll be fast, is number one is the disparities we're seeing in care in this country were there beforehand. It's not new. They're stunning now. And they're stunning for kids with disabilities. And our job, I think, in our professions is to stand up and say, we must provide care to children who live in poverty, from disadvantaged backgrounds, marginalized communities, because these kids, the disparities are huge. And this pandemic is just going to leave a massive widening gap. Yeah, those are some of the big take-homes for me, takeaways, yeah.
How do you think telehealth can close the disparities? I think it certainly brings them to our attention. But we still have scarce resources. And I think maybe what the challenge is to think creatively about how to use them differently. And I don't know that we've yet gotten to that point. I mean, we're still bailing this ship. Yeah. You like my expressions. One of my favorite expressions is when you're up to your tush in alligators, it's hard to remember why you got into the swamp. So right now, we're still up to our tush in alligators. But I think when we're able to take a step back, I'm wondering how we can just deploy our resources in a way that it is able to address those disparities better.
I agree with you. We are so in the thick of it, but we should be paying attention to it. I cannot profess to know the answers to it, but I tell you the one thing I would think about is I do think it's an opportunity to potentially, telehealth is an opportunity to reach rural, hard-to-reach populations. Like most people these days do have a smartphone. So I've been amazed at how many people have done very well with using their phones or their tablets. And I guess the only thing I would say and again, there's people who are far more knowledgeable about this than I am. I think there's a lot of people trying to get in the telehealth game, you know, providing cross-state care. And some of that stuff makes me really nervous. You know, I'm pretty nervous about providing care to somebody, you know, in New York who's sitting in California, has no real continued interest in that patient. That makes me a little nervous. So I guess it's a really simple thing I'm going to say. And again, there's people who are so much more knowledgeable than I am about this. But I think it's really important that we are sitting at the table when decisions are being made about how telehealth will be used and reimbursed. And what are the rules around that so that we make sure that it's being used in ways that do narrow gaps, do provide good care to people, and are not misused. So we need to keep our... And I think psychiatry, I mean, I think has been tremendous leaders in this area.
Well, places at the table is certainly something that we need to fight for. We're not a big voice. You know, there's not a lot of us, and kids are certainly not up there on the top of everybody's list. So I think that's a lot of advocacy we can do. In terms of your training hat, so in the minutes that we have, I was thinking about the fact that you've been as interested in training as you've been. What have you changed in terms of your training?
Well, you know, all the trainees now are being trained in doing diagnostic evaluations using telehealth. And I think a lot of the models, again, models of evaluation, some of these autism models of evaluation that everybody held as like so precious and so dear, I think are changing. Trainees are seeing that, and we have to just continually be asking our questions about the fidelity of the way we do things. And You know, are the results we're seeing, is what we're seeing and the conclusions we come to, are they valid? And we should always be doing that, right? We should always in training be doing that and thinking about the way we're doing things. But I think we've opened this door to this, at least for us, in looking at evaluations in a completely novel way and moving a little bit away from, again, kind of some dogma that does exist. And trainees are experiencing that. Now, what happens afterwards? I don't know, but I find that very exciting. Is there a corollary in psychiatry about that?
Well, I don't know that there is, but as you were talking and you were mentioning the autism business, I've been around for a while. One of my strengths is that I've seen so many kids and in a standardized way. You know, when somebody comes in my office, when they, pick up certain things or they look in the wall and so, I know that they're distractible kids. You know, they see a little mouse in the corner of my shelf. They're easily distracted. I don't have those props with me in telehealth. And so now I have to develop a whole new repertoire of standards, because I do think we have to do things in a standardized way. You know, I'm always after one of my fellows who writes down, George is tall for his age, 14-year-old boy. How the heck do you know whether he's tall for his age? You know, he's sitting in front of his cell phone. All you see is his face, you know, and he could be a midget for all you know. You know, you can't tell anything. So you have to re-standardize
I agree, and I'm not suggesting, although I have to say, I suspect when you're on telehealth, because you've been doing this a long time, you're going to come to the similar conclusions. That's my bet. It's for people who aren't seasoned clinicians that you do need a kind of some fidelity to the approach and some, but I'll tell you one thing that I've learned. We can harness the power of parents. So when we say to parents, you know, I'd like you to have these materials present, and we set up, if you will, some of the prompts, if you will, you know, again, for some of the things that I've been doing, we'll say to parents, you know, I'd like you to have these toys present. I'd like you to just play with them. Okay, just put the camera so I can see it. Mm-hmm. And I ask them questions of, is he looking at you? What's going on? Tell me this. And you think, well, I'm sure I do irritate and drive some of these parents crazy with all those questions. But parents can do a lot if we prepare them. We don't set the bar too high and we encourage them. We go, you know, we're not here to judge you. We're not here judging your parenting. Mm-hmm. We're here to set a scenario so we can get the best picture of your child. And, you know, the more we use things like standardized questionnaires, and we talk to teachers and we get kind of good collateral information, I think that we can create those pictures that you're talking about in a kind of with fidelity. But I think you're 100% right. That is going to be the task at hand.
Well, that's a good note to end on, because what you're saying is that parents are, we're working collaboratively with parents. That is what we do. We rarely can fix the kid in the visit. We're really helping to help to get the parents to help be an extension of us. And so now we're pulling them into the diagnostic piece. And that's a resourceful way of looking at it. All right. Well, on that note, I always like to end on a positive note. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Weitzman, for being with us. And I hope you will have a really nice, well, this is the holiday, but I hope it'll be a good holiday. And I hope that you stay safe. There's a quote that I use to end things, which is think positive and test negative. And I hope you do that.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for including me in this really interesting discussion. I appreciate it. And I wish you well and a happy holiday season.
Thank you all as well. This is Gay Carlson from ACAP.
Thank you all very much for tuning in. This is Gay Carlson for ACAP's Screenside Chats.